welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we must continue to seek His divine help, His inspiration in all things, especially in this particular cause, which is why we need to continue to learn, because you have to know and understand what you're dealing with to really be able to articulate and understand, one, you know, the problem and how to basically combat the problem. So therefore, we want to continue to learn, pray, and act. Now, next, the next obligatory is the focus on constitutional compliance. Folks, what this nation has missed for years and years, because we just believed that the legal system was working when it had been absolutely corrupted underneath our nose, we have to hold people accountable to the law. They're pretending the law, as I said yesterday, and so we need to hold them accountable to the supreme law of the land. So all that being said, we need you to actually use petitions, and the petition is the formal process of holding public servants directly accountable. Now, on top of that, we're also looking to restore our electoral college, restore our Republican election system of choosing our president, so that we can actually, you know, take back this country and take back the party control over the presidency and over access to our politicians. The party has assumed these powers when, and they were granted these powers by the legislatures, both national and state, and they've been ruling us ever since 1856. We need to take every facet of our government back, period. And to do that, we need to have a campaign. We need somebody that will actually run an election campaign that actually stands up and says, we want electors to choose the president. Because if we don't start doing it, we'll never, the democracy will overrun us, because we have to combat all of these lies and all this fake government with the truth and show people that this system is far better, and our liberties are far safer. That's a better way of saying it. They're safer than not. In other words, the Constitution, the laws of the land, and living within a Republican form of government is the safest place to live if you love liberty. If you want government to rule every facet of your life, then just allow them to continue going down this path. So with that, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we've got Massachusetts. We're going to dive into the Massachusetts debates. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So with that, one of the things I kind of wanted to start off with, if you notice, I actually have this highlighted to talk about, you know, what to do and how they kind of formed this convention, because it's kind of interesting. I'm not going to take the time to read, because what is happening here in the convention is one of those, you know, perfunctory things. I don't believe, and I don't think that they went down this path of going through the commission at all. But this may have actually been one of those three things where they actually challenged the commission, and we actually have some documentation. The house in which the convention was sitting, and different things. Okay, so anyway, I would just convince you to read this, because I forget why I did this. Agreeable to the recommendations of Congress were ordered to be read. Okay, so they kind of followed everything and how to go through this, and there's merit in it. I highlighted it for a reason, to show you exactly what the states were supposed to do and so forth. But that being said, the real part that we're going to dive into is a little bit down the ways. It's on Wednesday, January 16th, and it's Mr. Pierce, and it is basically about moral bankruptcy. So let's go. You ready? You ready? You on it?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
After reading the fourth section, wished to know the opinion of gentlemen on it, as Congress appeared thereby to have a power to regulate the time, place, and manner of holding elections. In respect to the manner, said Mr. P., I'm not sure who that stands for, suppose the legislature of this state should prescribe that the choice of the federal representatives should be in the same manner as that of governor, a majority of all the votes in the state being necessary to make it such, and Congress should deem it an improper manner and should order that it be as practiced in several of the southern states where the highest number of votes make a choice. Have they not power by this section to do so?
Okay.
Again, as to the place,
go ahead.
Continues Mr. P.
That's Mr. Pierce, by the way.
Mr. Pierce, okay. Again, as to the place, continues Mr. Pierce, may not Congress direct that the election for Massachusetts shall be held in Boston? And if so, it is possible that previous to the election, a number of the electors may meet, agree upon the 8 delegates, and propose the same to a few towns in the vicinity, who agreeing in sentiment may meet on the day of election and carry their list by a major vote. He did not, he said, say that this would be the case, but he wished to know if it was not a possible one. As the federal representatives who are to form the democratical part of the general government are to be a check on the representatives of the sovereignty, the Senate, he thought the utmost caution ought to be used to have their elections as free as possible. He observed that, as men have ever been fond of power, we must suppose they ever will continue so, and concluded by observing that our caution ought to be, in the present case, to be greater, as by the proposed Constitution, no qualification of property was required in a representative, and it might be in the power of some people thereby to choose a bankrupt for a representative. In order to give such representatives employment, or that he might make laws favorable to such a description of the people.
Okay, so actually, this is actually a comment that's kind of being brought up as an argument by an anti-federalist against this. And so when you actually read Mr. Bishop below, he observed that by the fourth section, Congress would be enabled to control the elections of representatives. It has been said, say he, that this power was given in order that refractory states may be made to do their duty. But if so, sir, why was it not mentioned? So actually, here it is. When you read the Article 1, Section 4, this is what it says. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Semicolon. So the federal elections are to be prescribed. In other words, the state legislatures are the ones to establish the times, places, and manner of holding those elections for senator. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So as we examine the following sentence, it says, but, right? There's a semicolon thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except to the places of choosing senators. Okay, so the reason that that was inserted, and we'll go through this, was to ensure that if a state didn't do this, that Congress could, because if a state was in chaos because of an insurrection, because of an invasion, or what have you, Congress could then call for the time, place, and manner to do it, right? Except for the Senate. The interesting part here is that they dallied on something that wasn't even listed as the requirement is for the state legislature to do it. The clause, but, is only to extend Congress the ability it enables them if the state fails. Okay. So
great.
Mr. King starts talking about states being bad actors because this is really why the concept of Congress having to do this, because as I've said before, states have been bad actors. They have been the problem. So let's go ahead. Mr. King.
Okay. The Honorable Mr. King rose and assured the convention that the state of Rhode Island did by a solemn resolution some time since recall its delegates from Congress. The Honorable Mr. Gorham confirmed what Mr. King had said and added that during the session of the Federal Convention, when seven states only were represented in Congress, application was made by two companies for the purchase of lands, the sale of which would have sunk $7 or $8 million of dollars of the continental debt, and the most pressing letters were sent on to Rhode Island to send on its delegates, but that state refused. The consequence was the contract could not then be made.
In other words, because only seven states were in session, and because these letters were sent out to Rhode Island for this opportunity for these two companies to purchase some land, then because they couldn't allow it to happen, they couldn't take care of the debt. And so what he's pointing out here is that the states weren't always there. They weren't in quorum in the Continental Congress. They were barely even tending to their duties in the Continental Congress. That's the point. So Mr. Bishop himself convinced of... I'll go ahead and read it. Mr. Bishop himself convinced of the fact, he proceeded... Am I going too far or what? You already read Mr. Gorham, right?
No, you're good, yeah.
Okay. He proceeded to observe that if the state shall refuse to do their duty, then let the power be given to Congress to oblige them to do it. But if they do their duty, Congress ought not to have the power to control elections. In an uncontrolled representation, says Mr. Bishop, lies the security of freedom. And he thought by these clauses that freedom was sported with. Sported. In fact, says he, the moment we give Congress this power, the liberties of the yeomanry of this country are at an end. But he trusted they would never give it, and he felt a consolation from the reflection. Okay, so down here, there's a little highlight regarding election attendance. Now, let me say this about the Massachusetts debates. There is a lot of really good stuff. This is, if there's a one book, one debate that you really want to read, and it's one of the shorter ones, Massachusetts is it, because most everybody here were members of the clergy. They also studied law. Like I told you, the framers were not lawyers. They may have been lawyers because everybody had that duty of, you know, practicing law or defending themselves and prosecuting, you know, for their own cases in common law. But they were all equally journeymen in chopping wood for burning fires. You know, so these were men of all talents and all phases of life. They did their job in all things. Does that make sense? Because today you got lawyers that can't even, I mean, some of them can't even put gas in their car. Or, you know, where's the oil? We've become so specialized in a particular trade that we're completely dependent on other people to do things for us. Now, I get it if you have physical handicaps or those types of things, but to not know the combustion engine, to not understand the sciences that, you know, these marvels that we live in today, and just so that you can be focused on one little thing, you know, how shallow is that person? So anyway, go ahead and read this little highlight under the election attendance. So, yeah, if you go down to the election attendance under Mr. Bishop, okay.
Okay, we also know that our town meetings for the choice of officers are generally attended by an inconsiderable part of the qualified voters. People attend so much to their private interests that they are apt to neglect this right. Nations have lost their liberties by neglecting their privileges. Consequently, Congress ought to have an interposing power to awaken the people when thus neglect.
Okay.
So when thus negligent.
Sorry. Yes, so another reason why. I mean, they are constantly thinking, what do we need to do? How can we make this better? What, you know, anyway, so if we go down now to Thursday, January 17th, the Honorable Mr. Turner actually makes some comments regarding paper money. And that is down onto the next page in yellow highlighted.
Okay. It gives me pain, and I believe it gives pain to others. Thus, to characterize the country in which I was born, I will endeavor to guard against any injurious reflections against my fellow citizens. But they must have their true characters, and if I represent them wrong, I'm willing to make concessions. I think that the operation of paper money and the practice of privateering have produced a gradual decay of morals, introduced pride, ambition, envy, lust of power, produced a decay of patriotism and a love of communitive justice. And I am apprehensive these are the invariable concomitants of the luxury in which we are unblessedly involved, almost to our total destruction. In the lower ranks of people, luxury and variance operate to the want of public duty and the payment of debts. These demonstrate the necessity of an energetic government. As people become more luxurious, they become more incapacitated for governing themselves. That's true. And we are. And are we not so? Alike people, alike prince.
There you go. So, absolutely. It is only, it's a cycle of, I'll just say, decay, right? I mean, you start off and let's say, you know, you pick yourself up by your bootstraps. I mean, here we are as a society that is just crawling to exist. And so we start, you know, learning, we start doing, we start making better and make better and make better. And actually, at this point in time, they were in the height of enlightenment. But they were already seeing how many people were taking it, you know, not taking self-government seriously. And so it opens the door, you know, eventually the guys in the room who have been entrusted to doing all of these work start looking over their shoulder and go, you know, nobody cares what we're doing here. And then somebody, the little devil in the circle, says, well, you know what? Maybe we could get away with doing this. Maybe we could pocket some money for ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's how it happens.
Yeah, nobody's going to notice.
There you go. And they start creating the honor of thieves and that den of thieves. Anyway, all right, so we're going to go down to where Mr. Rufus King starts talking about welfare. Yep. It's
okay.
Yeah, these are indents, so you'll notice that all the little notes are indents. So go ahead.
Rose to explain it. So Mr. King, rose to explain it. There has, says he, been much misconception of this section. It is a principle of this Constitution that representation and taxation should go hand in hand. This paragraph states that the number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. These persons are the slaves. By this rule are representation and taxation to be apportioned. And it was adopted because it was the language of all America. According to the Confederation ratified in 1781, the sums for the general welfare and defense should be apportioned according to the surveyed lands and improvements thereon in the several states, but that it hath never been in the power of Congress to follow that rule, the returns from the several states being so very imperfect.
Okay, so we kind of already covered this, right? They stated this in Pennsylvania, where Congress had problems actually doling out tax based on property value. And so they came to the conclusion that taxation had to be based on the citizen per head, per capita, to make it fair, because one of the things they even talked about in the convention was the fact that the value of property in Georgia is significantly different than the value of property in Massachusetts. It's significantly different than New York. I mean, there were some really depressed areas where, you know, the land was cheap. And that's always the case. As they even mentioned in the convention that as, you know, people started migrating westward, that land was going to be dirt cheap because supply and demand. There's plenty of land and there's not a lot of demand for it. So, hey, are you willing to sell some land? Yeah, shoot, I'll do anything. I'll tell you what, you buy 1 acre, I'll give you an acre. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's just kind of like, I got all these loaves of bread to sell. And so the only way I'm going to, you know, so I don't have to throw them away is I will, you know, you buy one, get one free. That's what happens when you have a surplus. So the value of land, because there's not, the demand drives the price. And so that's the whole point. They were talking about, you know, how do we justly tax? And we can't tax based on these perceived values. The best way to do it, they felt, was by apportionment, and which is one of the reasons why there was this direct relationship to the people, because that was the basis of taxation. It was also the basis of representation. And technically, when you look at the third paragraph of the second section, that's exactly what Article 1, Section 2 is saying. It basically says representative and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this unit. So this is where they actually lay it out that, you know, every representative cannot represent any more than 30,000 persons. That's a part of this as well. So that's where they are in reading this. And actually, Massachusetts was one of the few states that did a pretty decent job in reading the Constitution and then arguing it, reading it and arguing it. So as they're going through Article 1, they're just throwing some of these ideas, because this is January. I don't know how many copies were disseminated in Massachusetts. And I do know this, when the Constitution went out, it actually was printed in two languages. The other language that it was printed in was German for Pennsylvania. And so the Constitution was printed, and each state got so many copies of it, and whether you got a copy to read it or not, and I think it was kind of an indictment in some ways, when they're actually reading it and they're hearing it for the first time. In other words, many of the people at the debates in Massachusetts at this ratification debate probably didn't take the time to read it in the first place. How did they campaign to say, send me, you know, send me and I'll decide for you? Anyway, okay, yeah. So now we're going to go down past Friday, January 18th, and Mr. Davies is going to start making here's a comment regarding slaveries. Go ahead.
Okay, we have about a minute left.
Oh, okay. Actually, we don't have time to read this. So we're going to go into break. Now, I believe I told you that, and I proved to you that in Pennsylvania, it was laid out in the halls of the debate in the convention that slavery, the Constitution, the way it was designed, would eradicate slavery on its own. I believe the other state that says that is Massachusetts. And so, we've got Mr. Davies. You'll notice that as we start getting deeper and deeper into the arguments, you're going to find that, wow, they talk about corporations, the use of corporations and bankruptcies. They really start getting deeper and deeper involved into the debates. And as we get towards the very end, there's almost this spiritual tone that kind of takes over, because many of these men become so overwhelmed spiritually at the divine nature of the Constitution that they're, you know, basically, you know, recognizing the hand of God here. This is a very good debate for anybody that has any predilection towards Christianity and trying to understand the Constitution. This is a good debate for you. I think you'll really enjoy reading this. So we will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, well, that was a great catch anyway, since we only had a minute left. And so now Mr. Davies is going to talk about his observations regarding slavery. Go ahead.
Okay. He thought, however, that gentlemen would do well to connect the passage in dispute with another article in the Constitution that permits Congress in the year of 1808 wholly to prohibit the importation of slaves, and in the meantime to impose a duty of $10 a head on such blacks as should be imported before that period. Besides, by the new Constitution, every particular state is left to its own option totally to prohibit the introduction of slaves into its own territories. What could the convention do more? The members of the southern states, like ourselves, have their prejudices. It would not do to abolish slavery by an act of Congress in a moment, and so destroy what our southern brethren consider as property. But we may say that although slavery is not smitten by an apoplexy, yet it has received a mortal wound and will die of a consumption.
Okay, so that's kind of a forecast that slavery under the Constitution was, its existence was in question, right? At least that. It wasn't a profound, this Constitution will lead to that. I think that comes possibly even later.
Kind of reiterating what they said in the Pennsylvania ones.
Yeah. Right, yep. Okay, so as we then go down to the next one, I believe it is a couple days later. This is where we talk about corporations. Now, remember, the word corporation is not in the U.S. Constitution. Go ahead.
This section, Mr. President, has been subject to much dispute and difficulty. I did not come here approving of every paragraph of this Constitution. I suppose this clause is dangerous. It has been amply discussed, and I am now convinced that this paragraph is much better as it stands than with the amendment, which is that Congress be restricted in the appointing of time, place, etc., unless when the state legislature refuses to make them. I have altered my opinion on this point. These are my reasons. It is apparent the intention of the convention was to set Congress on a different ground, that a part should proceed directly from the people and not from their substitutes, the legislatures. Therefore, the legislature ought not to control the elections. The legislature of Rhode Island has lately formed a plan to alter the representation to corporations, which ought to be by numbers. Look at Great Britain, where the injustice of this mode is apparent. 8/10 of the people there have no voice in the elections. A bureau of but 2 or 3 cottages has a right to send 2 representatives to the Parliament, while Birmingham, a large and populous manufacturing town lately sprung up, cannot send 1. The legislature of Rhode Island are about adopting this plan in order to deprive the towns of Newport and Providence of their weight, and that thereby the legislature may have a power to counteract the will of a majority of the people.
Okay, so what they were going to do in Rhode Island was establish corporations. And they were pointing to the fact that in Britain, the same use was being done to where representation was being afforded to minorities and large bodies of people had no representation. Okay, so they're talking about like municipalities, corporations, those types of things. The federal government does not have the ability to form a corporation, to regulate a corporation, or to be involved with a corporation. If there is a case where a corporation is violating the Constitution, then that's something different. Because whether it be one entity or another, whether it be a state, a city, government, or whether it be a person, a violation is a violation, and if it arises under the Constitution, there is jurisdiction. So the point is that they're kind of highlighting, you know, some of these problems and this concept of how corporations would be used to actually disenfranchise the people. Why is this important? Because when we look in the mid-1800s, this is when the federal government started actually creating corporations. Again, we don't have time to try to find the documents and to go through this, but I'm just pointing to you that these men knew that when they go down this path of creating corporate governing, that is when the people become disenfranchised. And they knew it. They saw it. They pointed to it. And so, anyway, let's take the next one with the Honorable Mr. King and the use of corporations again. Go ahead.
Okay. Rose to pursue the inquiry why the place and manner of holding elections were omitted in the section under debate. It was to be observed, he said, that in the Constitution of Massachusetts and other states, the manner and place of elections were provided for. The manner was by ballot, and the places, towns, for, said he, we happened to settle originally in townships, but it was different in the southern states. He would mention an instance. In Virginia, there are but 15 or 20 towns and 70 or 80 counties. Therefore, no rule could be adopted to apply to the whole. If it was practicable, he said, it would be necessary to have a district, the fixed place. But this is liable to exceptions, as a district that may now be fully settled may in time be scarcely inhabited, and the back country now scarcely inhabited may be fully settled. Suppose this state thrown into 8 districts and a member apportioned to each. If the numbers increase, the representatives in districts will be increased. The matter, therefore, must be left subject to the regulation of the state legislature or the general government. Suppose the state legislature, their circumstances will be the same. It is truly said that our representatives are but a part of the union, that they may be subject to the control of the rest, but our representatives make a ninth part of the whole, and if any authority is invested in Congress, it must be in our favor. But to the subject. In Connecticut, they do not choose by numbers, but by corporations. Hartford, one of their largest towns, sends no more delegates than one of their smallest corporations, each town sending 2, except laterally, when a town was divided. The same rule is about to be adopted in Rhode Island. The inequality of such representation, where every corporation would have an equal right to send an equal number of representatives, was apparent.
Okay.
In the southern states, the inequality is greater. By the Constitution of South Carolina, the city of Charleston has a right to send 30 representatives to the General Assembly, the whole number of which amounts to 200. The back parts of Carolina have increased greatly since the adoption of their Constitution and have frequently attempted an alteration of this unequal mode of representation. But the members from Charleston, having the balance so much in their favor, will not consent to an alteration. And we see that the delegates from Carolina in Congress have always been chosen by the delegates of that city. The representatives, therefore, from that state will not be chosen by the people, but will be the representatives of a faction of the state. If the general government cannot control in this case, how are the people secure? The idea of the honorable gentleman from Douglas, said he, transcends my understanding, for the power of control given by this section extends to the manner of election, not the qualifications of electors. The qualifications are age and residence, and none can be preferable.
Okay, so it's kind of interesting because out the gate, remember, these were independent and sovereign states, and they still are. And out the gate, the way they kind of managed things, there were very few things that were common. The only thing that was truly common throughout these independent sovereign states were counties. They all had counties, and each county had a sheriff. And I believe when you really look at how they kind of move forward, they kind of fell back into that county, because if I remember correctly, the rule moving forward was to ensure that if you were going to create a county or consolidate a county, counties, the seat of government, I remember reading this somewhere, that the seat of government had to be within 1 day's ride. In other words, it would be too onerous for a person to participate in an election if they had to travel for more than a day. In other words, 1 day travel, spend the night, and a day traveling back after you voted. So it may be a 3-day trip. You'd be, you know, away from the house for 3 days while you went and participated in the election process. So my point is that there was really no standards for each of the states, and the federal government was constrained. They could not establish those standards. They could only basically help dictate time, place, and manner. When they say place, that doesn't mean the address. It means, I'll just say, the general place, like the county seat, the town, the vicinity of where they're to go. That the state legislature would then leave that actually to the counties, where the counties would dictate and allow, you know, the sheriff to decide. Because let's say you have a sheriff that can't write and read, then, you know, he's going to have some help or what have you. And he may actually just count by, you know, the raising of the hand. Back in those days, they didn't even have secret ballots. People stood around and or they sat in their wagons at this, you know, in the square, because they, you know, there's no point in bringing your own chair when you had a wagon. And, you know, I'm taking a lot of latitude because there was nothing that was absolutely hard, fast, right? People had different affluences and, you know, sitting on their horse, or maybe they walked into town. Everybody, you know, it was their duty and responsibility. One of the things we had already seen and heard was most of the people just weren't even, they didn't care. They weren't that interested in participating. They were being given this beautiful system, and many people didn't participate. If you actually go find the numbers, it'll be staggering to find out how many people actually voted to select their delegate to go to the convention to ratify this Constitution. People say it was a big mandate.
I mean, is it really any different today? Not really.
It's even much lower, because most people, they didn't care. If you were going to vote, you had to pay a tax. Today, at least, you know, with it being free and so forth, far more people do participate. But back in those days, well, shoot, I don't want to pay money. I need this money right now. I've got, you know, I got a hole in the wall. or I got to put a roof. I still got to put the roof on. Whatever. I mean, they were living in hard times. When the sun went down, there wasn't much to do other than sleep. So they got their share of sleep. And, you know, their lifestyle was, you know, not one that, you know, would go 24/7 like today. So anyway, I digress. The whole point is that they're really pointing out And you're really seeing that there is some real disparity between the different parts of the nation. Or I should say that the states were that much different from each other. Okay, so now the bribery and corruption. This is the one I really like, so you'll love this.
Okay. The most diabolical plan is on foot to corrupt the members of the convention who oppose the adoption of the new constitution. Large sums of money have been brought from a neighboring state for that purpose, contributed by the wealthy. If so, it is not probable there may be collections for the same accursed purpose nearer home.
All right, so what you're actually reading is a quote, and I don't know where the end quote was. So in other words, they actually read this out of the Sentinel. This is out of the newspaper, right? And so this, if you go right above this, somebody makes this mention, right? And he says, whereas there is a publication in the Boston Gazette and the county or the country journal of this day as basically saying this, and then the Sentinel kind of closing that. Mm. So then the committee take leave of debating the Constitution, and this is what they do. Go ahead.
Resolved that this convention will take measures for inquiring into the subject of the said publication and for ascertaining the truth or falsehood of the suggestion therein contained. Ordered that the messenger be directed to request the printers of the said Gazette to appear before this convention forthwith to give information respecting the said publication. Then afternoon, the messenger informed the convention that he had acquainted the printers of the Boston Gazette, etc., of the order of the forenoon respecting them, and was answered that one of them would attend the convention this afternoon. A letter from Messrs. Benjamin
Messrs. Benjamin Eads and Son.
Okay. Messrs. Benjamin Eads and Son, printers of the Boston Gazette, etc., relative to the publication, entered this morning, read and committed to Mr. Parsons, Mr. Nason, Mr. Gorham, Mr. Widgery, Mr. Porter, Mr. Gore, and Mr. Thomas Plymouth.
Okay, so I believe, if I remember correctly, the outcome of this was really more as a false flag. Because it is perceived that there, when you look at it, what is the underhanded thing? There's money coming in to help assist the ratification of the Constitution, to actually bribe and corrupt the convention, right? That's what the assertion was, mm-hmm. that they were pouring money in to give to people in the convention to go ahead and vote for it. That was in the news. In other words, it was trying to create this public paradigm that their government was for sale. And in other words, this was an anti-federalist ruse to disrupt the convention. Does that make sense? I mean, and it was effective because somebody brought it in, they stopped and they did this, and then they basically, because there's no evidence whatsoever that there was any proof, money, or anything like that that was coming forward. So, actually, if we go down to Mr. King, we're going to find this little note, and this is in blue, so go ahead.
I'm not sure where we're at.
Down further under Mr. King, there's a note and then money debt, these little indents way down. It's on page 41. Okay, so we had Mr. King talk about the use of corporations and the bribe corruption announcement.
Oh, I see.
Okay, all right.
Okay. And note.
Mm-hmm.
We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which that government shall be clothed. The introduction to this Constitution is in these words, we the people, etc. The language of the Confederation is we the states, etc. The latter is a mere federal government of states. Those, therefore, that assemble under it have no power to make laws to apply to the individuals of the states confederated. And the attempts to make laws for collective societies necessarily leave a discretion to comply with them or not. In no instance has there been so frequent deviation from first principles as in the neglect or refusal to comply with the requisitions of general governments for the collection of monies.
Okay. So, because paying the debt was important, you had to pay the debt. But one of the things that they were noticing was just the language. We the states or we the people. Technically, the Constitution, when it was being signed, it went back into the style committee to be shortened, and they changed that preamble from we the people, or actually it was we the people of the state of Connecticut, we the people of the state of Delaware, we the people of the state of, and they went literally through all 13 states. And then in the debates, or I should say in the body of the whole, they said, well, what happens if Rhode Island doesn't join? Then what are we going to do with the fact of we the people of the state of Rhode Island? Right. So what they did was they just eliminated the states themselves and basically says, we the people. There you go. That's why they kind of just said, they acknowledged that it was the people of the states. It went to the states, it went to them for ratification. But they wanted to, you know, reduce, you know, one, the length and, you know, be brief, because that's exactly what happened. It was documented that it went back to the style committee to shorten that. And that's what they came up with. So it wasn't something that was by design. Hey, we're not going to include the states because, you know, we're trying to undermine them. There's zero evidence of that. Okay. All right. So now Mr. King dives into the money debt part of, you know, what he was kind of setting up here. Go ahead.
This fact is true. The history of our own country is a melancholy proof of similar truth. Massachusetts has paid while other states have been delinquent. How was the war carried on with the paper money? Requisitions on the states for that money were made. Who paid them? Massachusetts and a few others. A requisition of $29 million were quoted on Massachusetts, and it was paid. The state has paid in her proportion of the old money. How comes it, then, that gentlemen have any of this money by them? Because the other states have shamefully neglected to pay their quotas. Do you ask for redress? You are scoffed at. The next requisition was for $11 million, $6 million of which were to be paid in facilities, the rest in silver money, for discharging the interest of the national debt. If the legislatures found it a difficulty in paying the hard money, why did they not pay the paper? But $1,200,000 have been paid, and six states have not paid a farthing of it.
Mm-hmm.
After mentioning another requisition, equally disregarded, Mr. King said, two states have not paid a single farthing from the moment they signed the Confederation to this day. If my documents are to be depended on, and they are open to the inspection of all. Now, sir, what faith is to be put in requisitions on the states for money to pay our domestic creditors and discharge our foreign debts? For monies lent us in the day of difficulty and distress? Sir, experience proves, as well as anything can be proved, that no dependence can be placed on such requisitions. What method, then, can be devised to compel the delinquent states to pay their quotas? Sir, I know of none. Laws to be effective, therefore, must not be laid on states, but upon individuals. Sir, it has been objected to the proposed Constitution that the power is too great, and by this Constitution is to be sacred. But if the want of power is the defect in the old Confederation, there is a fitness and propriety in adopting what is here proposed, which gives the necessary power wanted. Congress now have the power to call for what monies and in what proportion they please, but they have no authority to compel a compliance therewith. It is an objection in some gentlemen's minds that Congress should possess the power of the purse and the sword. But, sir, I would ask whether any government can exist or give security to the people which is not possessed of this power. The first revenue will be raised from the impost, to which there is no objection, the next from the excise, and if these are not sufficient, direct taxes must be laid. To conclude, sir, if we mean to support an efficient federal government, which under the old Confederation can never be the case, the proposed Constitution is, in my opinion, the only one that can be substituted.
There you go. So, again, we're really going to get a lot of information on the financial despair under the Articles of Confederation. And so as we jump down, Mr. Davies kind of dives into commerce. So let me go ahead and jump into this. As to commerce, it is well known that the different states now pursue different systems of duties in regard to each other. By this, and for want of general laws of prohibition through the Union, we have not secured even our own domestic traffic that passes from one state to state. This is contrary to the policy of every nation on earth. Some states have no commerce. The great and nourishing empire of China has but little commerce beyond her own territories, and no country is better circumstance than we are for an exclusive tariff from state to state. Yet even in this we rival by foreigners, by those foreigners to whom we are at least indebted. A vessel from Roseway or Halifax finds as hearty a welcome with its fish and whole bone at the southern ports as though it was built, navigated, and freighted from Salem or Boston. And this must be the case until we have laws comprehending and embracing alike all the states in the Union. And so I think it's probably best that I take a pause right there and we can pick up this last part, because what they're pointing out is that because these states are independent, they could make their claims of fees and tonnage and so forth as commerce rolled across their highways or their roadways to basically say, well, you're going to have to pay this much to go from this part of our state to that part of our state to carry your commerce. The Constitution wouldn't allow that. The Constitution didn't allow arbitrary tonnage and fees and so forth, only what was necessary, because states were making money because they were in the middle. They pointed out that some states didn't even have their own commerce. So in other words, all the commerce that flowed through that state was really from other states going to other states or into that state. Nothing coming out from that state. So the point is this, is that as they were looking at, you know, what these states were doing, they were making money off the commerce of others. And the whole point is that you don't make money off of your own family, right? It is repugnant to believe, let's say you're a member of the church. You know, you have a church member, I should say. You're a member of this church, and you have a church member, and he's notoriously making money off of members of the church. That's just wrong. It's the same thing with trying to make money off of your family. It is just wrong. It's one thing to be compensated fairly, but to be a profiteer at the expense of your loved ones, it's unconscionable. So the Constitution was designed to ensure that nobody had to be overextended from having to suffer the cost of, you know, commerce traveling through them. They at least were compensated as necessary to make sure that they weren't at a loss. With this, I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.